Erin Throgby. She is an associate professor in sociology at Warwick University. She tells me it's not in Warwick, so I'm today, but is moving to Leeds University in September 2013. Her research focuses on issues of gender, technology, and the body, and she is author of When IVF Fails, Feminism, Infertility, and the Negotiation of Normality. In addition to her work on reproductive and genetic technologies, she also has a research interest in obesity surgery. And more recently, she's been researching people's experiences of marathon swimming and is currently writing a book called Immersion based on that research. In addition, I also understand from Karen that she is an open water swimmer. Regularly, she tells me in the Lake District, and one of her recent more notable feats is to swim the English Channel. So, definitely further than I can swim. Although, Lewis is a swimmer. Perhaps you can swap notes with Lewis. So, over to you, Karen. Thank you very much for attending today. Quick round of applause for Karen and Mark.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me. In strictly documentary terms, I became an English Channel swimmer in the early evening of September the 2nd, 2010, when I hobbled beyond the waterline just south of Cap Grenet in France, 16 hours and 9 minutes after jumping into the water in Dover. Emails, texts and tweets poured in from people who'd been following the satellite track of the swim, welcoming me to the club. I was its 1,153rd member. But while completion of an iconic swim, such as the English Channel, carries what Thornton calls subcultural capital within the marathon swimming community and to some extent outside of it, what I want to argue today is that swim completion in itself is not the defining feature of authentic belonging to the marathon swimming world. Instead, what I want to argue is that the boundaries of belonging are drawn according to overt alignment with and obvious displays of respect for a set of core values which are taken to define the pure or authentic boundaries of the sport. And as will become clear, these are quite kind of neoliberal values about self-efficacy, self-responsibility, respect, and so on. And this will become clear as I go. For many within marathon swimming, the boundaries of authenticity are under constant threat of erosion, particularly potentially diluting the nature of the challenge and the implied moral status that gets attached to it. So, for example, in 2011, Scott Zornick, who's the president of the Santa Barbara Channel Swimming Association in Southern California, published two editorials in the organization's newsletter under the title, What's Wrong with Marathon Swimming? In the editorials, he issues an evangelical call to arms to shore up the imperiled boundaries of the sport, particularly in relation to the growing use of wetsuits. So he says, we must be loud and our voices must be heard. We cannot let up until our sport is purified and distanced from the sports which cause confusion. And I should say, this is not me attacking Scott Zornick. He's a very respected volunteer and participator in the sport. I'm engaging with the idea rather than a personal, and the same goes with several people who I mentioned. This is a kind of respectful disagreement, really, on my part, but an engagement with the idea. The sport of marathon swimming is locally self-governed, with no national or international governing bodies. For established swims such as the English Channel or the Catalina Channel in Southern California, governing bodies oversee, they observe the swims, they ratify the swims, they keep lists of successful swims according to the declared rules of the organisations. These swims all share an allegiance to channel rules swimming, textile suit, cap and goggles, no touching the boat or the crew during the swim, swimming from shore to shore, being clear of the water at each end. There are some localised exceptions within what are still widely acknowledged as channel rules swims. The regulations for the Cook Strait swim in New Zealand, for example, include the provision for the swimmer to leave the water for 10 minutes following the near sighting of a shark before returning to the water to continue the swim. I could imagine getting out. In the Round Manhattan swim in New York, swimmers can be taken out of the water in the case of a lightning storm, for example, and then returned to the water, whereas with an English Channel swim, once you're out, you're done. Okay, so those are exceptions that are still seen as channel rules swims. Unconventional swims that aren't governed by any clearly documented regulation, so Cuba to Florida, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, would be an example of this. are conducted under self-declared rules, either by aligning directly with channel rules or by establishing exceptions or alternative practices, so the use of shark cages, wetsuits and other aids. Compliance with channel rules, then, is voluntary, and it's perfectly possible, therefore, to swim the English Channel or any of these other marathon swims using a wetsuit or other aids. The swims wouldn't be recognised by the relevant governing body where there is one, but in itself the act would be permissible and possible within the bounds of maritime law and safety. As such, the rules take the form of an evolving ethics and style-based moral code against which the individual qualities of the swimmer come to be measured. This voluntary moral code and the inherent challenges of defining and maintaining its boundaries is the axis upon which debates around the slippery boundaries of authentic swimming turn. Using social worlds theory, my paper today explores this moral code in process, the social and sub-worlds those processes help to create, and the processes and relations of power through which the boundaries of marathon swimming authenticity are negotiated and contested. Social worlds are a set of common or joint activities bound together by a network of communications. And as such, unlike subcultural theories, for example, they're defined not by the relationship to the dominant culture, but by the production of a social object, in this case, marathon swimming. Social worlds aren't geographically defined, but are formed and maintained through shared language, practices, channels of communication, values and perspectives that arise from a common interest. As such, according to Strauss, they're characterised by three social processes: intersections with other social worlds, segmentations into subworlds, and processes of legitimation and authenticity. The focus of a social worlds perspective, then, is on a social change of groups emerging, evolving, developing, splintering, disintegrating, or pulling themselves together, or parts of them falling away, and perhaps coalescing with segments of other groups to form new groups, in opposition often to the old. This theoretical approach is particularly useful for thinking about these contestations around authenticity in swimming. The social world of marathon swimming is spatially transcendent, although with some geographical nodes of face-to-face contact. So places like Dover, San Francisco, La Jolla in San Diego are the kind of swimming meccas where people gather, but it's a much more transcendent sport. The social world is coordinated via networks now in the current moment of primarily online communication. For example, websites of local marathon swim bodies, discussion forums, blogs, and social media. And so for this paper, it's this online coordination that provides the primary data. And so I'm focusing on the debates that ensued following two particular, very well documented and very controversial swims in 2012 that led to debates about what counts as an authentic swim and who gets to decide. So importantly, and my goal in the paper is not to adjudicate what does or doesn't count as an authentic swim. Although, I mean, as a swimmer, I do have a view that does come out as we go, but the paper is not really a defence of my position. Instead, what I want is to explore how those contestations get enacted, what resources are available, what operations of power are at work in those debates and discussions. So I'm going to start briefly by describing the research project on which the paper is drawing, and then I'm just going to set out the two case studies from the 2012 swimming season, both of which triggered a massive explosion on the discussion forums and so on about these. It was sort of the most commented on issues over that season. And then I'm going to, in the remainder of the paper, using responses to those case studies, using those debates, look at sort of two issues, really: the arbitrariness of these definitional rules, and secondly, the importance of ideas of respect and style in determining what counts. So the paper is based on an ESRC-funded project that ran from 2009 to 12 that was called Becoming a Channel Swimmer. And this is the project's website. The project began with a very specific focus on the English Channel, but this became quite unsustainable when I realised there's a much more kind of global flow of people across different swims. So I shifted the focus onto marathon swimming more generally. Marathon swimming conventionally refers to open water swims of 10 kilometres or over, which is the Olympic distance, open water marathon. But my interest is really in the ultra domain of marathon swimming. So swims like the English Channel, sort of 20 miles plus, swims on the average are taking 10, 15, 20 hours of swimming. I'm also focusing primarily on channel rules swimming, although always with the derided other of the wetsuit sort of in sight. It comes up constantly in the research. The study combined extensive autoethnographic documentation of my own embodied process of training for various swims during that time, including the English Channel, alongside participant observation of training communities in the UK, as well as in Jersey, Cork, Malta, San Francisco, and San Diego, where I went and just hung out with the swimming communities. I also did 45 interviews with swimmers, coaches, family members, etc., and then accumulated kind of media reports, blog and discussion forum postings, published autobiographies of swimmers, and so on. And I'm currently writing this up as a book called Immersion, which is really a study of immersion as in obsession, as in becoming totally immersed in an activity, and also immersion as in literally what does it mean to be a body immersed in water. There's also a short magazine on the web, a magazine publication of key findings on the website that you can download. And I also keep a swimming blog that I use to disseminate a lot of the findings and just talk about my own swimming. And I can talk more about the methodology later if you're interested. So let's think about the case studies. These are both from 2012, and I've chosen them because they happen quite close together, so they actually there's a lot of cross-fertilisation in the commentary. And what I'm interested in is that they prompted quite significant and passionate debate, not only within the marathon swimming world, but also between the marathon swimming world and other sub-worlds around the sport, around open water swimming, for example, and with the non-swimming world as well. So there's three different kinds of interaction. And again, I'm going to tell these stories, but I'm not telling the stories of the individuals in order to kind of judge or expose or deride these people. I want to use them as a kind of jumping off point to access these debates. Okay, and so I want to use that as a kind of lens for a better understanding of the social world of swimming, of marathon swimming, and its kind of troubled longing for purity and clarity. So the first case is Brittany King. In October 2012, Shape magazine published a blog posting as part of its Motivation Monday series under the headline Meet the Woman Who Swam the English Channel. The post tells the story of 29-year-old Texas veterinarian Brittany King, who attempted an English solo English Channel crossing in September of that year. In question and answer format, King's narrative is one of hard training leading up to a swim and brutal suffering during the event itself, all framed within a fundraising project for a pet charity. Towards the end of the post, King notes that, quote, it's okay to adjust your goal if you have to, before explaining that the swim was completed in a wetsuit. An italicised editorial note at the bottom records that this means that, quote, her accomplishment hasn't been officially recognised because of the wetsuit. On her blog, King elaborated on the decision to use the suit, explaining that during training swims in Dover Harbour while she was waiting for good weather to swim, she really struggled with the cold. She told her pilot, the boat pilot, this, and she says that he suggested that she use a wetsuit. And although she was reluctant to do this, she eventually decided to start without a wetsuit, but take it with her just in case and put it on if she needed it. At some point during the swim, she put the wetsuit on and finished. And she, so she argues in the magazine, I found that sometimes you have to adjust your goal to reach your dreams. I never planned to wear a wetsuit, but I had to face reality that I'm not a penguin. My body just couldn't handle the hypothermia. Every person is different, but the end result was the same. And this is something I'm going to come back to, because it's kind of the crux of it. The president of the Channel Swimming and Piloting Federation is one of the organisations that governs Channel, that ratifies Channel Swimming. Nick Adams added some corrections in the comments section of the Shape blog, pointing out that King, in addition to use a wetsuit, also used fins, something that's never mentioned either in the Shape article or her own blog. In January 2013, the Shape blog posting was picked up by key swimming commentator Steve Monotones in his blog The Daily News of Open Water Swimming, under the headline, Fit for a King, but not for the Channel community. And so Monotone says, what we find surprising is that she had a wetsuit on board the escort boat in the first place, especially one that fit her. And so he's pointing to kind of pre-planning, premeditation. This isn't something that the usual English Channel aspirant does, no matter how honourable their charity Channel Crossing is. There's no shame in calling it a day, but calling for a wetsuit rubs the Channel Swimming and Marathon Swimming communities up the wrong way, especially when so much publicity is the result. And rub them up the wrong way, it did. Munatoni's post found its way onto the Marathon Swimmers Forum, which is a dedicated Channel Rules swimming forum, under the thread title, Who Earns the Title Channel Swimmer? And there were fiery debates that followed about what an authentic claim is and about publicity seeking and use of the media. So we'll come back to her. The second one, you may have read about this one. She had much greater publicity, is Diana Nyad. August the 16th, 2012, 62-year-old US swimmer Diana Nyad began her fourth attempt to complete the 103-mile crossing from Cuba to Florida. Her first attempt had been in 1978 using a shark cage, which creates drag that makes the swim slightly easier, which is why it doesn't count in channel rules terms. And this she wasn't successful, and the feat with the shark cage was subsequently completed in 97 by an Australian swimmer, Susan Moroney. Nyad went back to the swim in the summer of 2011, went in two separate attempts, both without a shark cage, but she failed as a result of difficult conditions and injury. Nyad's 2012 training and actual attempt, promoted by her Extreme Dream brand, which is that in the top left-hand corner, was the subject of extensive press attention, as well as being documented and promoted on her own website. The swim is a hugely expensive operation, and the New York Times estimated that one of the 2011 swims was about $500,000. And so Nyad signed up commercial sponsors, raised funds through public speaking, and visitors to the site were invited to support the dream by direct donation or by purchasing Extreme Dream branded goods. The marathon swimming community watched rather uneasily as the Extreme Dream operation gained momentum last summer. The publicity and commercialisation sat uneasily with many, as did the growing entourage of up to 60 crew. But at the same time, the audacity of the venture was completely captivating. Watching and waiting for the swim to begin, several technological innovations became the focus of intense debate. So there was a necklace-type device that dripped warm water down the sort of neck and shoulders and chest during feed breaks that was supposed to sort of help keep her warm. She had a textile full-body stinger suit that was to try and protect her from the jellyfish that come up at night, very painful jellyfish stings. And she also had an underwater directional streamer, which is on a pole and then that runs under the water, and she would just swim over the streamer, and that's to keep you going in the most efficient line. Okay, so there were these three that set everybody off in quite a big way. And these triggered massive debates, both on Nyad's blog, where supporters of Nyad clashed with marathon swimmers in the comments sections, and also on the marathon swimming discussion forums and blogs, really about the nature and boundaries of assistance in marathon swimming and what would count and what wouldn't. And these debates reached a much more furious pitch during the swim itself, which obviously happened over several days. Firstly, when news footage showed Diana Nyad holding on to one of the boats during a feed, which would be the end of an English Channel swim, for example. And secondly, when it became clear that she'd exited the water during a very fierce storm and then re-entered it, but how long that had been, it was never made clear, and so there was some concern about what had happened there. Okay, so there are those two cases. I'll come back to him in a minute. Sorry. So we'll just go on to kind of think about the responses to this. Firstly, to think about the arbitrariness of some of these rules. One of the defining features of marathon swimming as a social world is the purposeful location of the sport as traditional. Unlike many alternative or lifestyle sports for which innovation and creativity are integral, things like surfing and so on, the social world of marathon swimming identifies as fundamentally unchanged since Captain Webb's successful swim, the first successful swim, in 1875. And both the Channel Swimming Association and the Channel Swimming and Piloting Federation, which are the two organisations that govern English Channel Swimming, explicitly cite Webb on their websites as the historical and ideological pioneer of Channel Swimming. And I won't read these, but you get the idea. The discursive mobilisation of Webb as the reference point for the sport's boundaries of authenticity is a very common strategy in attempts to distinguish the social worlds of Channel Rules marathon swimming from other forms of open water and long distance swimming, like in triathlon, for example, that kind of swimming. US swimmer, blogger, and co-founder of the Marathon Swimmers Discussion Forum, Evan Morrison, made this case very explicitly in a blog that he wrote in support of Scott Zornig's editorials about purification. In the post, Morrison posits tradition as the first of three traits that make marathon swimming unique, and the other two are unpredictability and the very real likelihood of failure. And he says, tradition, the knowledge that when we enter the water to begin a long swim, we're using the same simple technology, textile suit, cap, goggles, as those who came before us, as far back as the 19th century. What other sports can boast as level a playing field over time? Strauss argues that when subworlds split off from parent social worlds, the process often involves the rewriting of the prevailing social world history by discounting some aspects of the past, or, for example, toppling founding fathers and substituting them to create alternatives that fit the new subworld's narrative and operational ideology. But in these appeals to Matthew Webb as the touchstone of traditional swimming, the authentication of the sport doesn't come via an alternative history, but a very strongly worded reminder of a history that's perceived as at risk of being swept away. But it's also really important to note that the origin story itself of Webb as setting the technological standard for sort of the boundaries for swimming is very partial. In particular, the channel rules of textile suit, cap and goggles are commonly cited as a direct inheritance from Webb's 1875 swim, but in fact he wore neither cap nor goggles. Instead, the first recorded use of goggles in English channel swimming came in 1911 by the second person to swim the channel, Thomas Burgess, and watertight goggles didn't make an appearance until 1926, when Gertrude Ederle, who was the first woman to swim the channel, successfully sealed her custom-made motorcycle-style goggles using paraffin wax before her successful swim. This technological advance, the goggles, was in turn necessitated by another fundamental transformation in swimming technology, the development of front crawl, because it required that the face is submerged in the water for large parts of the stroke cycle, which is not with breaststroke, so goggles then become a necessity with front crawl. Furthermore, I mean, even within the bounds of textile suit, cap and goggles, since then there have been significant technological developments in materials and designs that have undoubtedly changed the experience of swimming. And this is without even mentioning the array of navigational, nutritional and training technologies that are integral to the sport, but whose legitimacy within marathon swimming remains uncontroversial. So what we've got is this kind of inevitable arbitrariness about what counts as a significant or legitimate or illegitimate change to accepted practice. And this opens up the space for debate. This is where these debates happen, in that gap. And these debates get played out through a series of discursive strategies that pitch innovation and adaptation against tradition. For example, in a blog post responding to opposition to NIAID's proposed warm water drip device, which one marathon swimming commentator described as an abomination to the sport, NIAID positions herself instead in response as a problem-solving trailblazer. So she says, many of us in this sport are entering new territory in these swims that have never been done. While respecting the clear rules of no unnatural flotation, no help in forward movement, many of us are innovating as much as we are plain swimming. NIAID mobilises the rhetoric of the pioneer entering new territory to align herself simultaneously with the spirit of adventure that is fundamental to marathon swimming self-definition and a progressive narrative of adaptation and innovation, which is not part of that self-definition. Opposition to this innovation was expressed primarily via the slippery slope, the premise that incremental changes to the practice of the sport, even while potentially within the letter of existing voluntary rules, steadily accumulate until they fundamentally and irrevocably transform the sport into something entirely different and, more importantly, lesser. And you also get this on the forums if someone posts a question that seems to even suggest they're looking for an easier route that would make it easier. They tend to be jumped on as kind of diluting the sport. Hyperbole is a really important strategy in producing this. So this is the kind of comments people posted on NIAID's blog. I await the introduction of inflatable armbands to channel swimming. While you're at it, why not just put a mini jacuzzi off the side of the boat? Those kind. But we also see this hyperbole in defence of the innovation as well. So those who are advocating for innovation or the use of wetsuits are equally hyperbolic basically to try and refute what they see as unreasonably purist loyalties in the face of kind of common sense adaptation. As one of the comments on Nyad's blog expostulated in response to critiques of her innovations, what's next, swim the Arctic in a bikini? Both sides of the argument then characterise the other as completely ridiculous, either as clinging foolishly to outmoded and self-defeating standards, or as eroding the very qualities of the sport that are seen to give it value in the first place. These fiercely contested clashes of social value are central to the social world of marathon swimming, and they provide an explanation for what you'll see in training sites, which is the kind of habitual mockery from marathon swimmers of triathletes and their attachment to the wetsuit, or the wimpsuit, as it's often referred to. It's a very kind of macho posturing. It's a very macho posturing which serves to emphasise the heroism of marathon swimmers in relation to the cult. And you'll often see people kind of feigning quite exaggerated expressions of disgust if they have to touch a wetsuit, you know, to sort of help zip someone up or something. And this tension is exacerbated by proximity, because marathon swimmers and triathletes often share training spaces, in open water training spaces. And what this does is it forces a retrenchment of opposing positions that actually denies the reality that sees many swimmers moving back and forward between triathlon and marathon swimming in their own sporting biographies. And it also really brings to light the fact that this is a clash of social values, not a clash of goal interference, for example. So people with wetsuits and people without wetsuits can train happily together without interfering with each other's projects. Whereas, for example, a swimmer couldn't train in the same space as a water skier safely. So it's a problem of social values, not goal interference. But what's interesting is that even though these debates for the internal definition of marathon swimming are kind of fierce and ferocious and sort of treated as ultra important, externally they are largely irrelevant. As Kiowa observes in relation to the similar contest that you get in climbing between traditional climbing and sports climbing, if the distinctions are blurred to insiders, from the outsiders they're quite invisible, and climbers are climbers to most people. And this is important if we want to understand the online debates, especially those debates following news articles or blogs that reach an audience outside of the marathon swimming world. So while debates within dedicated marathon swimming sites end up kind of focusing on trying to adjudicate between what would be allowed and what isn't, is a streamer okay or isn't it? Debates between those inside and outside the social world of marathon swimming are really about whether the rule is necessary at all. The invisibility of the debates around technological innovation and wetsuits in marathon swimming to outsiders then comes out in the public comments to both Brittany King and Diana Nyad, and particularly through clashes with marathon swimming insiders. So, for example, on the Daily News of Open Water Swimming blog about Brittany King, a reader left a lengthy comment attacking the blog's author, Steve Monotone's, for summoning up wrongdoing where none simply existed, concluding, "It remains highly unlikely that any of the pets who receive life-saving support from the charity will give a rat's ass if their salvation came gift-wrapped in a wetsuit." The complaining reader doesn't disagree with the substance of the non-wetsuit rule so much as the fact that there is a rule at all. So for this reader, it's an arcane, carping, mean-spirited distinction that's in sharp contrast with the charitable motivations of the swim. In a similar vein, after the release of Zornig's newsletters, I wrote a blog post which argued that excluding wetsuit swimmers was bad for the sport of marathon swimming, and that clarity about the conditions of a swim was all that was required. However, I also suggested that the unmodified claim to have swum the channel is to imply that you have done so by channel rules. One reader left an irritated response in the comments, like the previous extract, repositions the insider-outsider boundary. "I'm swimming the channel next year in a suit," this is what they posted. "I don't particularly care if a group of people that not many other people care about don't certify the swim. Okay? Will I have swum the channel? Well, I wouldn't have walked across, would I?" The purest position here, which is actually not my position, but the purest position here, is rendered the domain of an unrepresentative handful of miserly, self-important killjoys who take themselves and their sport too seriously. For this commentator, as Brittany King said of her own swim, the end result is the same. But for the purists, however, the refusal to accept the non-wetsuit-wetsuit distinction only serves to actually reinforce this sense of uniqueness and distinction of the marathon swimming social world. For them, the end result is far from the same because of the style of the crossing. It's a distinction that can only be appreciated by those in the know. As one commentator remarked in the online debates about NIAID's drip device, the only people qualified to understand the context of the debate are other marathon swimmers and those involved in our sport. So the debate then becomes one of who can and cannot call themselves a marathon swimmer and who has the authority to speak on the sport's behalf. And in fact, one of the most common silencing strategies in the debates was that the marathon swimmers would ask this sort of swimming out to the outsiders whether they're a swimmer or not as a way of kind of silencing their views online. And this points to the centrality of these two ideas of respect and style as the social values that sort of self-define the world. Scott Zornig takes a very hard line on who gets to use the title marathon swimmer, particularly in relation to wetsuits, wetsuit swimmers, whose activities he refuses to recognise as even falling within the domain of swimming. So he says, my simple request is please don't label it long-distance wetsuit swimming, a marathon or endurance swim, because it falls into a completely different category, which the word swim has no part of. Right? So positing water adventures or water exhibitions as alternative descriptors, Zornig argues this way people can still receive some credit for their endeavours, yet it stops them from reigning on the parade of true marathon swimming accomplishments. Kiwa found a similar linguistic territorialism among traditional climbers, whose attempts to distinguish their social world from that of sports climbing with its bolts and aids in many ways mirror those of marathon swimming. And this, I'll just let you read that down. So this climber is saying, basically, if you do any of these things that are outside of the style of traditional climbing, then you're not a climber. You don't get to use the term. And these fights over naming highlight the nature of the clashes as about social values. In the face of ambiguity posed by technological and practical innovation, both swimmers and climbers have to turn to ideology to demonstrate commitment to tradition in the face of these perceived threats. So from a social world perspective, the circumscription of the term swimmer or climber can be understood as a battle not simply of how to define a social or subworld, but also its status relative to others. In short, Zornig's case is for marathon swimming to be the unmarked primary category, the social world from which the others have branched off into a lesser practice. So for swimming purists, these subworlds aren't moral equivalents, and to claim otherwise is to disrespect the achievement of authentic swimmers and the style in which those swims were conducted. It is to rain on their parade, according to Zornig. And the extensive use of publicity by both King and NIAID serves as a lightning rod for these accusations of disrespect. So in the case of King, this was somewhat, you know, this person described her as a publicity hound who skewed the facts to promote herself when so many kind of authentic swimmers don't get a word written about them. And what you get in the comments is there's a number of figures, very well-known figures in the swimming world, who get kind of cited as alternatives. Webb is used often in this way as authentic swimmers, but also swimmers from the same season who had either performed extraordinary feats of endurance to complete a swim or who had failed in their swims, who had chosen to get out rather than accept the aid of a wetsuit or another. And so to stick to the rules even without failing. And this is what I mean when I say that success and completing a swim is not the defining characteristic of belonging, because in a sense failure, unsuccessful swims within channel rules shore up the self-definition of the sport as a uniquely difficult challenge. So there have to be failures as part of that. So this highlights what I see as an essential paradox in the construction of authentic marathon swimming. The marathon swimming world is self-defined in part as that which is, by its extreme nature, beyond the understanding or recognition of those who are outside of that world. But at the same time, recognition of those values from outside is actively demanded, especially when we've got alternative representations coming to the fore that potentially undermine those values and practices. So it's a tension between you can never understand versus please understand that are happening at the same time. And in this way, purist accounts of swimming form a second paradox, whereby a practice that's defined by stepping outside of the securities and comforts of rationalised modern life through this allegiance to a tradition is subjected to ever-decreasing circles of rationalisation in the hope of solidifying, sort of pinning down those boundaries in this context of constant change. Okay, so to conclude, it's a completely gratuitous swimming photograph. This is my favourite kind of ending picture from the end of my Catalina Channel film. So by focusing on two case studies which acted as these triggers for online debate about what counts as authentic marathon swimming, I've argued firstly that marathon swimming is defined less by the completion of a specific swim, but rather by demonstrable allegiance to and alignment with social values such as fortitude, respect, self-efficacy, and a commitment to certain styles of swimming. I've argued that the actual substance of the rules is inevitably arbitrary to some degree, but that this is less important to the construction of pure or authentic marathon swimming than the ability to align those rules discursively within this framework of those social values. And secondly, I've suggested that the narratives of purity and authenticity in marathon swimming are never only about the kind of internal social world definition, but also constitute attempts to establish a hierarchy between intersecting worlds. Distinction, then, can only ever be established in relation. And this is a reality that refuses the purification and entrenchment to which these rationalised claims to authentic swimming aspire. So I think this shows two things. Firstly, I think it shows the kind of usefulness, perhaps, of a social world's perspective for thinking about sport, and particularly for thinking about social change within sport, both within a given social world and also in interaction. Marathon swimming is a sport that takes place almost entirely out of mainstream view, but literally in its physical practice, but also symbolically. And as such, a subcultural perspective that looks at relations between sub and mainstream cultures doesn't really capture the micropolitics that go on in the sport and through which swimming defines itself. And I think a social world's perspective offers an alternative way of looking at the ways that marathon swimming as a produced object becomes meaningful to its members and how that membership is policed. And the second point is really, for all the paradoxical circularity of much of the work of shoring up the boundaries of swimming, this analysis also demonstrates the intensity with which many people engage with the sport and for whom it is a fundamental element of their identity. On a personal level, as both a swimmer and a sociologist studying swimming, I feel troubled about demands for purification because of the exclusions and unspoken privileges upon which such calls tend to rely. But again, as both a swimmer and a sociologist, I'm also deeply drawn to the intense passion for the sport that those online debates signify, and in many ways which I recognise in myself and my own engagement with it. The nature of this immersion, this obsession, is kind of a paper for another day, but the passionate authenticity debates online are one symptom, I think, of this intense consuming engagement with swimming and its values that I find simultaneously both quite disturbing but also very deeply appealing. Thank you very much.
Thank you for an excellent presentation.